This is episode number 45 of The Big Web Show. This is a show we talk about content strategy, topography, the web in general. It's everything web that matters. The show is hosted by none other than the godfather of the web, Jeffrey Zeldman, or as his friends call him, Big Z, Jay-Z. And we'd like to thank some sponsors for today, for the show, for making it possible. First one is Rackspace. Back in February, Rackspace asked if you had what it takes to be king of the apps. And many developers took up the challenge to build an application on top of Rackspace cloud files. And back at South by Southwest, they awarded $10,000 to Snap Appointments. They were crowned king of the apps. And now it's time for round two. You can win $10,000 in cash and prizes as long as you submit your app by May 2nd. You go to rackspace.com/king of the apps, and you have a chance to win $10,000. I'll be announcing the winner at Interop in Las Vegas. So be sure. Then any kind of app you want, just use cloud files. That's the only requirement. Second sponsor, Shopify.com. These guys are the best. I use these guys anytime we want to sell something. We use them for the 5x5 store. I've used them for Hive Logic. Amazing. You can choose from their really awesome templates or completely go crazy and customize your own thing. That you can use your own CSS, your own HTML. You can make it look exactly like your own website, whatever you want to do. Or just use one of their amazingly designed templates that already exist. And normally there's a 30-day free trial. But if you use coupon code 5x5, you will get 3 months free. 3 months free. That's right. I had to say it twice. Shopify.com. A shop in minutes, a business for life. Go check them out. Love those guys. Jeffrey, you ever use a Shopify?
We use them for A Book Apart. We use them for Happy Cog. Happy Cog designed some templates for them. We love those guys. They're
love
amazing.
Love those guys.
How do they give you 3 months for free?
I just said, guys, you need to do something for the listeners, or that's it.
And 3 months
said,
free.
They
that's
said, we'll
crazy.
Do it. We'll do whatever
that's
you
totally
want.
Crazy.
Yeah. Whatever you
I
say.
Like that. I like that. I dream about that. Well, today, not to waste any more time with my dreams, today we have a very exciting guest, Mr. Tim Murta. Known most recently for HTML5 Reset.
Yes.
Can we get a screenshot?
Yes.
I'll work on that. I'll work on it right now.
HTML5 Reset just launched version 2.0 and included a WordPress theme, or should we say anti-theme, almost a non-theme.
Right.
It's almost like vodka. You know, I used to think like the better the vodka, the less taste. Right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
That's what vodka's for. Vodka's the alcohol for people who don't like alcohol.
For adult, right. It was always my favorite. And this is the blog theme for people who really don't like, who want to start their design absolutely clean. It's basically,
yes.
It's a reset. Right. So we're going to be talking about HTML5 Reset. He's also a partner in MonkeyDo, a two-person web agency in New York City that makes a really amazing little app that hasn't come out yet that I've seen that I desperately want for my phone, but they're not giving it to me yet. Not that I'm bitter.
Really?
Maybe at the end of the show.
Maybe at the end of the show.
We might,
It's called Kielbasa. I'll just leave it at that. The app is called Kielbasa, and it's just amazing. Tim
is... this monkeydo.biz, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. That's our very neglected portfolio site.
It's a fantastic portfolio site, which works differently on an iPhone. Very nice. Responsive design, mobile thinking, all the stuff is here. And also the transitional arrows. And I believe you did that with Flash, correct?
No.
I'm just kidding. Tim's a web
standards guy. Don't even joke.
He's a web standards guy going way back. Tim does go way back, although he is quite young. He started very young, so he's still a young man, relatively. I see a little male pattern baldness starting, but
good.
Still,
I don't want to be the only
We like to get you down in the dirt with us. But he started with some of you may remember back in the 90s, pirated sites. Piratedsites.com was the site.
I remember
that
site.
Yeah,
pirated sites.
It was good for a while.
For the listeners who don't know, the ones even younger than yourself, Tim, what was Pirated Sites?
Well, Pirated Sites was, so that was back in the day when K10K was a force to be reckoned with, and everybody had to read K10K every day. And it seemed like at least once a week, people would go on K10K and complain about either K's design itself being stolen or some other website that they built being stolen. So I just decided to create a place and call it Pirated Sites to capture those screenshots and kind of in perpetuity. Well, not in perpetuity because it's offline now, but to publicly shame those people for stealing those designs.
So it was kind of like Hot or Not, only before Hot or Not. It was like Original or Not. And you'd set them up side by side.
Yeah, yeah.
And ask people to vote on. And how effective
was
that?
No voting. It was just people whose sites were pirated would submit it to me. I would check it out, do a little due diligence to make sure that, yes, the people who say they own the site, and I would just put it up. And then it's just a public shaming. So thousands of people visit every month and see, oh, well, this developer is stealing designs. So he better change his ways or we're not going to use him anymore, that kind of stuff.
And those were in the days when we would start a website because we had an idea. And we didn't need investors, and didn't have to be a $1 billion idea. It could just be a neat idea. Like, so you had a neat idea.
Yeah.
And the barrier to entry was learning HTML, which I guess you already knew, right? You were you working at Icon Design? Icon Nicholson or before that? Okay, right. And since that time, another indie site that you do, that you've done with Mike Pick via MonkeyDo, is Cloud King, right?
Yes.
Cloud King, which won an award for best CSS-based website at South by Southwest.
I could be wrong, but it may have even been the first year that they featured that category.
Love this site. Oh, so
I'm kind of proud of it.
It's amazing.
So we're still doing background here, but talk to us about this a little bit. This is an actual online gallery for artists, independent artists?
It is. We really just took it on as a personal private project just to kind of stretch our legs. We were both working for the same agency at that point and working for clients like MasterCard and Bank of America and Citibank. And so Cloud King was really our chance to, A, explore the new thing called CSS, which was coming out, but also to make something kind of beautiful and creative that, you know, wasn't the, you know, the Blue Cross Blue Shield website we were working on during the day. So it was never a business. It was always just a personal project, a labor of love. And so, so it's been up all these years.
And it
still looks great.
You from time to time get new artists?
We've been focusing on other things lately. But yes, from time to time we will introduce new artists. It's overdue for a push. You know, some of the stuff in there is stale now, although still beautiful, but we could really use some new blood, so to speak.
Your design partner, Mike Pick, did, one of the most amazing CSS Zen Garden skins in the history of CSS Zen Garden. What's called like Under the Earth or something.
I think it was called All Things Below or something like that.
All Things Below.
The top of the page was a layer of grass, and then all the content of the site was you progress you through layers of dirt. And then at the bottom of the design was a little, like a star-nosed mole burying itself underneath your content.
Yes. Yes, that's right. I think it was the one, even before I knew Mike, I used that screenshot in the first edition of Designing with Web Standards to say like, no, it wouldn't have been the first edition. It would have been the second. In the second edition, it would have been, It's like, here's what you can do.
It was definitely one of the more striking designs.
Yeah.
In the Zen Garden.
MikePick.com is down. It's down.
Yeah.
What happened?
It's his big chance. Well, that's one of the things I'm going to want to talk to you about if you're not uncomfortable doing it, which is you and Mike are as talented as any two people I know on the web, but you don't promote yourself so much. Now, he's Canadian and you're Midwestern, and I think that has something to do with it.
That definitely plays a role. It absolutely does.
So we're going to talk. We had Karen McGrain on the show, Karen, who is responsible for the design they're still using at NewYorkTimes.com, the amazing redesign of NewYorkTimes.com. And I had her on the show and I said, now why don't more people know who you are? And she said, well, I'm from Minnesota.
That's true. And
now you're from
I moved to New York City 12 years ago, started temping just to get things going. And constantly people would say, you're from the Midwest, aren't you? You're from the Midwest, aren't you? Yeah. We have a weird, quiet work ethic that we get things done. We want to do them right. But it kind of keeps us in the background, which is great in some ways, but not so good in others. It's great for supporting an organization from beneath. It's great for quiet leadership. It's not good for being Jeffrey's album. It's not good for...
Hey.
Well, it's not... You know what I mean? You need...
I grew up in Pittsburgh. I'm from the Midwest.
I'm sorry.
I like the Midwest. Hoagies, baby. Hoagies. We had hoagies in Pittsburgh. What do you have? Where are you from?
We had those in Philly, too, the hoagies.
Yeah.
No, we don't have hoagies. We have submarine sandwiches.
So we had submarines in... Connecticut, and then they switched to hoagies when we moved out to Pittsburgh.
So it's not just where you're from. It's a matter of personality, and it's also a matter of how you want to interact with the world, I guess. It's, Mike and I are both relatively quiet. We like to focus on our pixels. We like to think about our ideas. We like to put them out there. But we're not those front guys. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I want to talk about one of your biggest ideas, which is HTML5 Reset. But first, I just want to look at some of the client work you've done recently, like World Science Festival.
WSF.TV is a video platform based on Expression Engine that Mike and I just designed and launched. So for those who don't know, Mike does the design and I do the HTML and any technical implementation. So WSF is designed by Mike, integrated by me. It's an Expression Engine site. It uses the Amazon cloud to serve video. It's actually on DreamHost virtual servers.
Really?
Yeah.
And it's working fine?
Oh, it's working great. We love it.
It's awesome. You made this for the World Science Festival. You also redesigned their website, correct?
The current homepage of their current website, worldsciencefestival.com, is a new design, and we're actually in the process of getting ready to launch the new version of their entire site. And actually, that TV site will be subsumed by their new site. So WSF TV is about to go away and just become worldsciencefestival.com.
How did you – you have a whole bunch of science sites. That seems to be one of the niches you guys – feel very well, and I wonder how that started for you. How did you know? What makes these kinds of clients reach out to MonkeyDo?
Well, I think that's what happens when you get most of your work through word of mouth. Is people we started? I think 4 or 5 years ago, Mike and I had recently done Cloud King, which got us the attention of Seed Media Group, which was publishing at the time Seed Magazine, which was a science journal. They wanted a blog. They came across us, called us, and we built them a blog. It was a blog that doesn't exist anymore. It was just for one event. But from that connection, they said, hey, we need a magazine website. So we did that for them. And then they said, hey, we need...
And that was seedmagazine.com?
That was seedmagazine.com, yeah.
Which is still up and still very beautiful.
Yes, absolutely. It's a great, great site. We love it and are proud of it. And then from seedmagazine.com, they said, hey, well, why don't you build us a network of blogs? And we'll call it scienceblogs.com. And that's still up and doing very well.
Were you responsible for the writers too? I mean, how did it work?
They came to us with an editorial vision and a community manager / editor who was ready to wrangle all the content of the site. So we did the technology, we did the design, and I actually worked for them a little while, being their behind the scenes tech guy. So Seed was our first client in the science space. But then word of mouth just gets out there and then other clients come to you as well. So last summer we did a site for a small scientific educational organization called City Science. We did some work with you and with Roger Black and redesigned scientificamerican.com.
Right. Which we like very much.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. I didn't mention it, but so HappyCog Philly is staff company. HappyCog San Francisco is half staff, half virtual company. HappyCog New York is virtual company. And I actually co-opt MonkeyDo. A lot of times you're in here and you may be working on something for HappyCog, you may be working on something for MonkeyDo, or you may be working on something for yourself. But you're the smart guy that I like to have around. So we do share an office. In fact, right now, we're in adjoining cells, which is kind of cute. Like, we almost could be doing this from the same desk.
He's over there.
He's over.
There's
he's
a
over
wall there. Between.
There is a wall. Otherwise, we'd be hearing each other with a time delay. And that would be freaky.
It would be wrong.
So, Tim, how much of a role do you think being in New York City nowadays is playing into this? I mean, we talked about you being from the Midwest a little bit, but where, you know, and this is a question I ask everybody all the time, and maybe I'm sounding like a broken record here, but there's a lot of people who aren't in New York. There are a lot of people who maybe are in the Midwest or some other location, and here you are sitting 10 feet away, typically, or less, maybe even 3 feet away from the godfather of the web. Do you think that plays a role in the kind of projects that you get exposed to because of that proximity, or are these things that you'd be able to do just as easily from wherever, from your desk in the Midwest?
Well, I think definitely sitting next to Jeffrey Zeldman, you know, occasionally has its benefits. Absolutely. If only because you were hearing him talk about things. He follows 1,200 people on Twitter. I don't know how many people.
It's crazy, isn't it?
He knows everything and everybody that's going on. So I learn a lot just by sitting next to him about what's going on. Stuff that I, you know, might have picked up on, but a week later. Stuff that I may never have picked up on because they're people I'm just not aware of.
I mean, couldn't you just follow Jeffrey Zeldman on Twitter and get all the same thing? Or is there something about being there in the office and eavesdropping on his calls and knowing what he does? And
Jeffrey in particular has an energy about him. And, yes, it's useful to sit next to Jeffrey sometimes and just watch him go.
Yeah. I mean, I just sometimes like to see him change his desktop background, you know, just watching that would be exciting for me.
He doesn't have any staff, so people ask him what he does. And people ask me that question. I say, you know who Jeffrey Zeldman is? That's what he does. Jeffrey Zeldman is Jeffrey Zeldman all day.
Wow.
He's on the phone. He's on Basecamp. He's working with List Apart. He's working with Happy Cog folks. He's talking to folks about the events. He's on the phone, on the Twitter, on Basecamp all day, every day. And he makes it work. But that having been said, I think for me, it's less about sitting next to Jeffrey Zeldman than it is about sitting next to somebody.
Really?
I think co-working, like if you're working from home, you're missing out on an opportunity not to just get outside of the house and see the sunshine, but also to show other people the stuff that you're working on, see the stuff that other people are working on, become inspired, inspire other people, make those social connections, which, you know, I follow less than 100 people on Twitter because I'm very deliberate about who I follow. But there are people who on Facebook have thousands of friends, and
right.
And what those particular connections don't have a whole lot of value in the real world. You know, it may be great to be able to broadcast some news that you have to all your thousands of followers, but when it comes down to the stuff, at least the way I work, when it comes to this, to showing people my work and getting feedback on it, you know, those nebulous connections aren't valuable to me. So for me, it's I'm either here or I'm at a co-working space or I'm working out of another friend's apartment alongside him. It's really important to keep those real social connections up and running.
But so having said that, you could do that in theory if you could find somebody with some similar interests. You could do that from anywhere. You could do that from.
No, absolutely.
Even from the Midwest, right. You could do that.
And that is I think that's kind of my point here is being here in New York, most of my clients are from New York and some of them are extremely interesting. Like, you know, stumbling into Scientific American Project with Jeffrey Zeldman is a fantastic thing. But those kinds of projects are, even though the organizations may be different, you know, every town has a local magazine. Every town has a local marketing department, marketing and advertising agency. You need to get out and meet those people and get your stuff in front of them so that they know, you know, not just that you're out there, but what you're working on. And Twitter's good for pushing that kind of stuff out too, but people only passively listen to that stuff a lot of the time, you know, especially if you're like Jeffrey and you follow thousands of people. Not everybody's as diligent as he is about paying attention to everybody. So even though you may be connected to somebody on a network, I personally don't put a lot of value into that tenuous connection unless it's somebody that I can actually reach out to and say, hey, take a look at this. What do you think of it?
I agree that it doesn't have to be New York. It doesn't have to be somewhere. I get so much from sitting next to Tim. Easily as much as he gets out of sitting next to me. And I learn stuff all the time too, because everybody has different preoccupations and different skills. And I'm constantly, I'd even, there are sites I'd even forgotten existed that Tim would, you know, like Tim would follow something at Boing Boing or Metafilter, sites that I, you know, could, that I wasn't passionate about anymore, although they're great. Like, those are great sites, but just I hadn't looked at them for a while, and I'm like, oh, yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. He'd say, look the way they're doing this. And I go, wow, you're right. It's like, you know what it is? It's like you listen to Talking Heads for a while, and then you have like two or three favorite Talking Heads albums, and then you don't listen to them anymore, even though they're still great, but they're not, you're just, they're not doing it for you for some reason. It's kind of like that. Like, you just have your musical taste, film taste, book taste is always moving on for whatever reason, just restlessness of spirit, I guess. And it's the same way with websites for me. And so Tim's always finding stuff that I don't know about, or he's finding stuff I used to know about and realize I don't really know at all anymore. And, it's fantastic. That makes it sound like he's the archivist of the web, but it's weird how much stuff he does know, considering, again, he's a pretty young guy. But it's weird. There's like internet years. Remember when people used to talk about internet years?
Oh, yeah.
And I think remember, those, that's Swatch a real thing.
Remember Swatch had an internet time watch?
Yeah. I've met people in their 20s who are old in internet time. They're as experienced as I am. And, you know, and they're like 20. Well, I guess they, yeah. It could be like 29. That experiences me. That's kind of scary. So what's the deal with HTML5 Reset? Why did you make it? And what do you hope to do with it? And how should people use this?
Well, I really kind of launched it on a whim like 6 months ago when I was updating my own personal set of HTML and CSS documents, like the set of templates that I start every project with. I have, you know, over the years collected a series of best practices. You know, I do... You know, I always start an HTML file the same way, always end it the same way. And then according to the needs of every project, you know, I pick stuff out and I put new stuff in and stuff like that. But I'm always starting with the same baseline. It was around 6 months ago that maybe it was 9 months ago that that your HTML5 book came out. And I read that and immediately became an HTML5 convert because it's kind of a brainless transition switching from XHTML to HTML5 was totally seamless. It was completely easy. So I, over the next couple of months, started updating my own personal templates to be HTML5 and then changing the reset classes in the CSS file. And once I had that together, I thought, well, might as well make it available because there are a lot of people who are going to be going through this transition. So if you can give them a starting place for them to make their own, you know, set of baseline templates, then why the heck not? So 6 months ago, HTML5 Reset launched. And as you said, just yesterday, we launched a new version of the site with version 2 set of files, including a completely blank and style-free HTML5 and HNews microformat compatible WordPress theme. We provide the HTML and you provide the styles. That's all there is to it.
What's the HNews microformat compatibility about? What's that for?
Oh, the HNews is HNews is just one of the microformats available on microformats.org. And applications like Readability and I believe Google News use it as an indicator of like if their system identifies a page as being a possible article, if your article page is HNews compatible, then it has hooks to grab onto and say, oh, I know this is the title. I know this is the byline. I know this is the published on date and so on.
So you'd look better in Flipboard if it was compatible with this, or you'd look better in Readability if it's compatible with this. Okay, so you've got a template that – so it's for people who know what they're doing. Now, when you came out with do you have separate styles for each browser, or how do you – or it's all one style, or it's all one file? How do you
It's actually, that's the biggest difference between version 1 and version 2 of the HTML5 reset files is we used to have a full set of, I think, like half a dozen files for IE, for specific versions of IE.
Right.
Over the past year or so, over the past couple of years, actually, we've noticed ourselves, or I've noticed myself using those IE-specific styles less and less and less as we're adopting progressive techniques, you know, stuff that just doesn't show up in IE. I don't need to fix it in IE because it's okay if it doesn't show up. So, and then IE8 is not actually a bad browser. And now that IE9 is here, and is actually a really good browser, those extra downloads for those specific versions of IE just became less and less important. So with version 2 of HTML5 Reset, we have migrated to what is now pretty much the standard of using conditional classes to apply IE-specific conditional comments to apply IE-specific classes to our HTML tags, so that in our single CSS file, we can say nav border color equals blue, and we can also say IE7 nav border color equals green. So we have specific classes for IE instead of extra style sheets. We don't have any extra classes for any other browser except for IE, because everything these days has kind of having been doing this for like a decade, it's kind of unbelievable to me that I can write the same code and have it work the same in most browsers. It's still magical to me, but that's the case. We are where we want it to be, practically. You know, there are still quirks to overcome in some browsers. You know, you might do something that you've never done before and find a browser reacts a different way, but that's also the point of the reset, is to kind of bring all those styles back to a base minimum, so that the browser reacts the way you want it to react instead of the way it decides it wants to react.
So Tim, I mean, is this, sorry, Jeffrey, is this for everybody? I mean, who should be using this? There's people who are like, okay, this sounds cool, but like, should I use this? Should I go back to older projects and do it? Is this something I should is it safe to integrate into an existing website? Is something going to break? You know, paint that picture for me.
As for who it's for, anybody who's starting a web project. It's very accessible. It's very simple. There's another project called the HTML5 Boilerplate by Paul Irish, which is actually
That's like your nemesis there.
He's your arch nemesis.
Well, it's not. It's not really. It's
destroy that guy, right? Take him down.
It's essentially the same thing. It's a series of templates, a series of files designed to kick off a project. But the scope of what HTML5 Boilerplate does is so broad and so deep that it's not for everybody. It's not for the entry level designer. It's not for the entry level developer. It's not for somebody who
show the site? I don't even know if we should show the website here.
I highly recommend it for the serious developer working on serious projects. But the difference between HTML5 Reset and the Boilerplate is the Boilerplate takes a lot of learning. There's a lot of stuff in there that even I had to learn about when I looked through the documentation. It's not a simple thing. You need to spend some time figuring out how to pick it apart and which components to use, which components not to use, what's appropriate for your project, what's not appropriate for your project. So the difference between the Boilerplate and the Reset is that the Reset is a very surface level skin of HTML5 and CSS to get you started, upon which you can apply just about everything. The Boilerplate is much more complex.
The Boilerplate, I would say, is a platform, and the Reset is a reset.
That's one way to put it, definitely.
So if I want to go and take this Reset thing and integrate this into 5x5.tv right now,
right?
Is this a full-on design project to do this, or is this just going to fix some things that might be broken that maybe I don't even realize? In other words, when I do this, am I going to have to commit days of time now to fix everything that it just broke, or how does this work?
Well, it's designed for a project that's starting from scratch. But if somebody asked me to take the Reset files, and like if you asked me to apply it to 5x5,
yeah.
It wouldn't take me all that long, because it's really just a matter of like this, the stuff in the Reset files kind of sit outside everything that you've already done. You've got your styles, then I'm going to stick my Reset CSS stuff up here and maybe my mobile and print suggestions down here. So for an existing site, it's a little more, you have to figure out where to put stuff, but it's definitely not going to be a nightmare. For me, personally, to not knowing much about the 5x5 website and how it works, I could probably safely estimate it might take me a couple of hours to actually transition it to an HTML5 Reset set of templates.
Where do you net out on asterisks? Are you a big, here's an asterisk for everything, or do you follow the Eric Meyer method of specifying all the elements?
I specify all the elements. I actually took I started with the CSS Reset classes that HTML5 Doctor provided when HTML5 first started being used maybe a year and a half ago. So I, and that's another thing about the reset files is it's just like all the other stuff we do. It's a lot of best practices borrowed from other places.
Right.
But we don't do the asterisk thing. The asterisk thing is a little, it can be problematic because it will do things that it'll do things to element that to elements that, they don't need them to be done. Like you don't necessarily want borders to be taken off of inputs by default.
Right.
So we, our approach is a little more thoughtful. We have thought about every element and, you know, how we want it to react to the CSS, to the reset styles. So no, it's not just a matter of blowing everything away. It's getting back to kind of an empty but useful baseline of styles.
You have, you list as influential projects and articles, which is, I assume, things that you learned from. You have HTML5 reset style sheet, which you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. You also have an article by Quirks Mode called "A Pixel Is Not a Pixel Is Not a Pixel." What's that about?
Right. Well, that's really kind of about mobile and how a pixel. Well, it's about mobile and it's about being able to zoom in on a website. You know, as soon as you zoom in on a website or if a user visits your website, you know, at something smaller or greater than the normal zoom level, the pixels they're seeing, like the box that I told the browser to be 100 pixels wide is now 200 pixels wide. So there is no literal translation of a pixel is a pixel any longer, especially when you take into account mobile and the iPhone 4, which has double the density of the previous iPhone. So even though the iPhone 4 reports the screen as being 480 pixels wide, it's actually twice that wide, but it has to report it as being 480 wide so that to be consistent with previous displays.
Yeah, I used to make fun of the whole, the description of a pixel as a relative, as a relative term in a relative unit of measure in by the W3C, but of course I was wrong. It really is a relative measure, and as usual, it's Apple that convinces us that all this stuff that seemed theoretical 10 years ago is actually true.
Right.
What about, you have, speaking of Apple, you list the Safari Web Content Guide as a reference. What did you learn from that? The kinds of things we were just talking about, or?
Well, there's lots of little things to learn from that in terms of like making your website's web app compatible if you want them to be, how to design and install the Apple Touch icons that show up on your home on a user's home screen if they save your site to their home screen. You can customize all of that stuff. You can customize whether or not it opens in web app mode, and if it does, you can customize what color the toolbar is. Small stuff, but it's stuff that adds to the user experience.
Do you have is there a default when I use this, is there a default is there a default Safari icon or a default phone icon?
We put the code snippets in place and point you in the right direction or tell you how to set it up. It needs to be, you know, so many pixels by so many pixels. If you want iOS to put the shiny bevel on it, then do it this way. If you don't want iOS to apply its little shiny shadow to it, then do it.
You can control
way.
That. I never knew that. You can control that.
One of the fun things you can learn in Apple's documentation.
See, I never read documentation, and that's just so wrong. But I've wondered about that. Yeah, I wondered about that. It's fantastic.
Tim, I've got kind of a little question just about the design of HTML5 reset as a whole. Mm-hmm. And that is, I mean, I love simple, straightforward, clean sites like this in general. But here's something interesting. I want to ask, is this a trend? Because right now, this is a one-page site. You see there's a navigation, but if you click an item in the navigation, right, you click the code, it just jumps down. It doesn't go to a separate page. It just jumps down. Is that a more modern trend? I mean, what's the thinking on doing it that way as opposed to having sub-pages? Is this just something that's convenient, or is this a new trend of having a single-page site?
Well, it's definitely convenient. That's for sure. Having to maintain a site that's one page is... The way I work is simpler than handling multiple pages. I haven't gone so far as to integrate this with Expression Engine or anything. So I'm just manually editing this HTML file. I think we've seen sites like this they've been around for a long time, but I think people are starting to like the idea of what we've been calling the single serving site for a while. Sometimes they're uber simple, right? There's like, is avagotodad.com, I think, is one of them. And all it says is yes or no. The other is the classic, does a website need to look the same in every browser.com? Which just tells you yes or no and actually demonstrates that no, it does not. I think I actually started this project with the intention of just making a single serving site. And I think in that spirit, yes, I want it all on one page. Me as the creator, I don't want to have to maintain multiple pages. Me putting myself in the position of the user, it's all here. You know, I don't need more information than this. I don't need any more pages than this. So I think it speaks to the simplicity of both the product that we're offering, but also the ease of use that we would like to suggest that this product has.
It's also a squashy, stretchy site, is it not?
It's a little bit responsive. It's a little bit responsive. If you make the window, like if your browser's full size, you'll see that the screenshots kind of hang off the right side a little bit. If you make the window smaller, they'll tuck themselves into the content just to make sure that we're, you know, not causing a vertical scroll bar anywhere. And then if you open it up on mobile, the images don't float anymore. They just are right in right. line with the content.
Right.
So yeah. So a single serving site is really easy to make responsive, in my experience.
How do you test nowadays, and what do you test for? You've got you usually got three or four machines. Well, you've got at least two machines, three machines open on your desk. What do you generally look for when you're making sites? What kind of baseline are you setting in general? Not on projects like this for the public, but no, I'm sorry, for this community, but on
you mean
projects
what kind like of-
For
what
clients.
Kind of level of consistency am I looking for?
Yeah.
I'm looking for as much consistency as possible. Absolutely. There are certain things like shadows and rounded corners, which I will sacrifice for the sake of simplicity. You know, it's 10 times faster to do those things in CSS than it is to try and create images for them. And I can't remember the last time I did that, honestly.
But I know, me either. I've forgotten testing, how.
When I'm testing, those are really the only things that any of the advanced CSS3 stuff that we've started using recently, those are the only things I'll sacrifice. My partner and I are both generally pretty rigorous about making sure that stuff looks the same.
What's your approach to hover versus touch?
Mm.
That's a good question, and it's not something we've actually thought out for ourselves a whole lot. We haven't been building a whole lot of sites or with kind of application like experiences where hover becomes an issue. For the stuff that we've been working on recently, hover is an enhancement. It's not a function.
Disclosing needed functionality or right. You don't exactly. Hover to navigation or something. Yeah. So it's just,
and I guess that's just the way we've been effect. Working for a while. So it hasn't been an issue for us. That having been said, we are working on a project right now that does have, unfortunately, it will require hidden drop down navs. So we will have to figure out what to do about that. But it's just a matter of capturing those touches or those clicks with JavaScript, right? And just instead of taking you to the page that it would normally take you to, making the hover come down.
One approach I don't like, which we've actually done, but I don't think we'd ever do again, is to just reveal all those dropdowns as in-page nav on a phone. And the problem with that is that you can scroll through three screens of navigation before you get to content, and it sort of undoes right. all the good usability stuff and all the accessibility stuff we learned over, you know, in the past. I mean, there are skip links, but,
right.
you know, right. that right. skip links are for expert users also, and, you know.
Right. And like I said, we don't normally do that sort of thing, so I don't actually know what the best practice is, but we're about to need to do it, so it's on my list of things to figure out.
It almost seems like, in many cases, the best practice is to create a different mobile experience. Like, so you have all these dropdowns and all this navigation on a browser, you know, in a desktop browsing experience, but maybe you have a more content-driven, simplified navigation.
Well, then you get into the question of is it actually a different mobile experience, or do you just want to style it differently? And in my head, that the difference between those two things has become, is it a mobile experience that I'm applying, or am I just styling for a small screen? All the progressive stuff or the responsive stuff that we just mentioned about HTML5 reset, Those are just styles for a small screen.
That's small screen stuff.
A mobile experience. That's a small screen experience.
That's just small screen stuff.
But if you're going to talk about a mobile experience, to me, that's like a whole other effort. You need to figure out what those users want, what they're coming to your site for, and what content to present. And it's unlikely that you know, what you're presenting on your main site can actually be easily reconfigured to suit the mobile user.
I would venture.
We don't like
I
to make mobile sites. We like to kind of make small screen design decisions.
I would venture to guess that content skews more towards small screen. You can probably get away with small screen, like restyling. Sure. And application skews more toward we need a fresh mobile experience. Like if I'm doing an airplane, you know, a site for people to buy airplane tickets and then check the reservation, it's not enough to just make sure that everything's in a, you know, big type in one column. It's going to go beyond that, and you really have to. So we could probably make one of those little charts, right, with the where they used to have like clever, stupid, brave, cowardly, where, you know, and the you either want brilliant and brave. No, you end up wanting stupid and cowardly is the manager you really want. What's it? You know the thing I'm talking about.
That's the quadrant I usually avoid. It's the stupid and cowardly.
Yeah. It turns out that's the one you want to hire from. No? I've been wrong? I've been doing
this
wrong?
It's the one a lot of people end up hiring from. That's true. Okay.
I thought stupid and cowardly was because you don't want stupid, but you don't want stupid and brave. That's the worst because they'll destroy the company. Stupid and cowardly won't wreck the company. They'll be too afraid to make change. But stupid and brave will go, I know what this company needs. And then they'll just drive everybody off a cliff.
Exactly.
There we go. But anyway, we could make a grid like that for a mobile experience for systems. So are you going to start a trend calling things like small screen?
Not something I invented. I've seen one or two other people use the term recently, but I do think it's a nice distinction. When we restyle a site for a mobile phone, what we're actually doing is just restyling for a smaller screen. It doesn't have to be a mobile phone. It doesn't have to be a mobile device at all. It could be the kiosk inside the elevator that tells you what the news is that day. You know, that's not a mobile device. That's something else. Call everything mobile is a little short-sighted, I think. And it's also not fair to the mobile user, I think, because the mobile user does have specific needs that take a lot of thought and work to accommodate.
Right. Where am I right now? What angle am I holding this device? All that kind of stuff. That, like, if you're taking a magazine like a list apart and just making a smaller page, it really doesn't matter where you are. You're not trying to locate. Find another web designer near you. You're not really trying to do that.
And the difference to our clients is also significant because to adjust a site for a small screen might take me an extra half a day, honestly. Like, it honestly took me 5 minutes to figure out the small things I wanted to do for HTML5 reset. But if you want a full-on mobile experience, that's almost a completely separate project and has huge impact on time and budget.
Tim Murtaugh. What's next for you? I mean, here you are, a new, big shot New York City designer, big shot web guy, off the just fresh off designing this reset.
Medium shot.
You got the whole world, right? And you're young. I mean, you're barely out of your teens. What's next for you? What's the next for you? I mean, you think about this. Here you are. You're poised. I feel like you're poised. You got Cloud King. You could relaunch that thing and you could drop that bomb.
We could.
What's next? Can you give any hints?
Well, my partner and I have been debating about whether or not to talk about this publicly, but I think it might be time, actually. So this is not that big a deal, but we think it's a whole lot of fun. So we've been working on this project first of all, we wanted to figure out, we wanted to learn a lot more about the Google Maps API. So we thought about the things that we could track. We think sites like Yelp and other, you know, where can I eat apps are great, but we think their focus is in completely the wrong place. Their focus is usually on, their own website and their own structure and their own navigation. And here's the review and here's your Facebook connection and here's your blah, blah, blah. And the map to the place where it actually is somewhere off to the side. And if we think the map should be the most important thing. So, we decided to build a site using the Google Maps API and to start tracking food trucks around New York City. And we deliberately chose food trucks because they're kind of the most complex kind of object you can track. Like a restaurant is in the same place every day. It's open the same time every day. But a food truck is open at multiple times during the day in multiple places. So we kind of deliberately chose the most complex set of data we could choose. So we've been working on this website called Edible City, and you can find it at ediblecity.com.
I love that name. Man, you and these domain names, it's nuts, man.
I have crazy. Like 4 dozen domain names. Most of them have never been used. But if I have an idea for a domain name, it's $10. It's $10. But ediblecity.com, it's kind of in a closed beta right now, but I'd be willing to give you guys the password. And the password is lunchtime.
Oh, can I type it here and record what I'm doing on the...
Yes, you absolutely can. Unfortunately, it's kind of the middle of the afternoon, so there aren't a whole lot of food trucks out there, but there are a few on the map, so you can see them.
Look at this.
So, oh, I know.
Take a look.
Man alive, this guy's good, Jeffrey. Where did you find this guy?
I know.
God.
I found him on pirated sites.
Look at this.
So here are the trucks. Want our food finding experience to be. It's full on map. You know, I don't really
click
care.
On something. Click
I don't
on
care
something,
as
man.
Much about reviews or, you know, what my neighbor's friend thought about the place. I just want a map.
That's
I want to
crazy.
See what's close to me. I want to see where it is. I want to go. So, and if you open it up on the phone, it'll actually try and geolocate you. And then orient the map to where you actually are, and so it'll show you just the food trucks that are.
You've got little different icons for the kinds of trucks.
Yeah, that's all, Mike. Mike is pretty awesome. He's a great illustrator as well as a web designer.
Great.
So he's
so good.
We have a couple dozen of those little truck icons.
And this is an iOS app or iPhone app as well.
No, web app.
Just web on available
you
could, with
you
a
can
custom.
Put it on the phone.
Oh, so good.
Yeah. Yeah. So what you just loaded in Safari is
what you will load on your phone.
So
good.
Yeah. So there's a lot of kinks to work out, and actually tracking these trucks is a pain in the butt. But
now, is this something they have to participate in? Do they have to be willing for you to do this? Do they help out?
No, we are. Most of them broadcast their position either through Twitter or Facebook or on their website. So we're doing a little scraping. We're doing a little Twitter listening. We're doing a little manual, like where are they? I'm plugging it into our system.
Yeah, this is a little cool
What's
little custom
again?
Scroll bar that you can scroll in the nice translucency. Yeah, it's just so good.
Password is lunchtime.
This is really hot. This is really hot.
Yeah. So that's something fun we've been working on in our spare time, learning a lot about Google Maps, but also kind of learning a lot about the mobile user and how we can – like the – This what you see at ediblecity.com, if you go in your desktop browser, it's the mobile view, just much, much bigger.
I'm just typing lunchtime right now, and I'm hungry. Dough, lunchtime isn't working anymore for me.
Uh-oh.
Maybe we've crashed.
Dough, maybe there are too many users now.
Works for me. Working.
That's kind of possible.
Lunchtime.
It says
Although
dough.
Anybody who actually digs in and...
No, it works for me, Jeffrey. You're doing your usual edge case thing.
I'm gonna do done. I'm gonna hit I'm hungry.
I just hit enter.
Here we go. iPhone users use Edible City as a web app. You
Love
thought
this.
Of that.
Love
and the
this.
Home screen, of course. This is beautiful.
So,
and there's the truck. There's the truck. I hope listeners are doing this at home as we speak.
And the
or
other
your
thing
desks.
Kind of,
this is so
the thing
hot.
That's kind of silly about Edible City is it's based
Edible
on expression City. Engine.
Really?
We probably want to be using something a little more data friendly than Expression Engine, but right now it's being driven by Expression Engine.
What's wrong with Expression Engine?
It's just not nearly as flexible as we want it to be in terms of displaying times and places. But it's gotten us this far to kind of a proof of concept. So at some point we'll look into some more generic application engine instead of just Expression Engine.
Drupal.
Perhaps.
Drupal.
I would hope not.
No.
Drupal.
I know. I like to say Drupal.
Uncle Gussie. So you guys in New York, you eat out of these trucks?
Yeah, absolutely. There's been a giant trend toward like gourmet food trucks. So
sounds awesome.
In Austin too, where you're moving, there's lots of these food trucks.
This is I can't wait. And is it like a taxi where you just stick out your thumb and they drive up and they what do you want to eat and you tell them what you want to eat?
They park.
Oh, so you could go over there where they're serving up the food and you say, hey, you know, give me a slider.
Right. So they'll be in one place for a couple of hours for lunch, and then they may, you know, pull up their steaks and go somewhere else for dinner.
So do you know, I guess the problem that you're solving here is you didn't know where the good ones are, where they're going to be, how to get to them. Cause it's like a restaurant, but it's not like a regular restaurant where you can say, you know what, let's go here tonight, or let's go get a bite to eat for lunch. You got to figure out where these things are to get there.
Right. Absolutely.
They don't come. You can't just stick out your thumb. They don't come to you.
Right. And
wouldn't that be cool if they could do that?
What really makes this work for like a mobile first philosophy is half the time when you go out for lunch, you're already out the door before you try and figure out where you're going.
Right.
So that was why we made it a web app and not like, and didn't just turn it into a Yelp like giant, you know, standard website with navigation and links and blah, 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 blah. This does one thing. We hope it does it well.
How does the app know where the trucks are? Really? Asks Paul Scott. And so do I.
I think pretty much all of the phones now have geolocation built into them.
How does it know where the trucks are?
How does it know where the trucks are?
Right. I know how it knows where I am, but how does it know where the trucks are?
It knows the trucks are because we are scraping Twitter a little bit, scraping Facebook a little bit. There are a couple trucks that we have to manually update. Hopefully we would want to – we've actually gone so far as to figure out how much it would cost to just put a geolocation device on every one of the trucks. And the cost is actually minimal. It would be less than $100 per truck per year to have them broadcast their location to us. But right now it's
via XFID or something?
Something. I don't know. Something more technical than I can handle at the moment. But right now all the locations are just coming from social media and from their websites, which is kind of why there's also a couple of notes everywhere that says, please make sure to check their Twitter feed to make sure they haven't gone somewhere else.
So you're doing translation of words to visual. So like someone literally on their Twitter feed, they might say, we're pulling up Madison, coming close to 23rd. And somehow you'll translate that to a position at Madison Avenue and 23rd Street. Is that how that works?
We're doing some of that, but it doesn't always work. So we still have to do some of the trucks manually. Some of them do have set schedules, but I'd say that only like 75% of the time are they on their set schedule.
They're all around Union Square and Madison Square Park.
Yeah,
very nice for us.
Most during the middle of the day, most of them are smack in Midtown, which makes sense because there's millions of people working in Midtown in very tall buildings.
And up by St. Patrick's Cathedral, what can the Cardinal have? He can go to Joyride.
Yeah, Joyride. I haven't been to Joyride yet.
For frozen yogurt.
Joyride is coffee and frozen yogurt.
Yes. Are you testing all these? There's a lot of waffles. I'm surprised how many waffles and dinghies. What is a dinghy?
A dinghy is a Belgian topping for a waffle. So like a sugary thing or a fruity thing or a powdered sugar. But the Belgian waffles are pretty fantastic.
Now the Quick Stop Kosher has what looks like a bacon strip on top. Is that some kind of like anti-Semitism?
It's actually a falafel inside of a pita.
It's a falafel inside of a pita? Yes. What is it, like a falafel pita?
Well, you know, it's a falafel sandwich. But the Quick Stop Kosher truck is always parked out in front of B&H. And if you're from New York, you aren't going to be surprised.
B&H is where they...
It's the huge photography store run by...
Hasidic Jews.
Exactly.
So that they can... Yeah, okay. This makes sense. Van Leeuwen Artisan Kangaroo. I'm not sure about that one.
Oh, Kangaroo is just the name of the truck.
I know that.
That particular truck.
So you can't just stick your thumb out and they don't just pull up?
I wish. Really,
that'd be a cool thing. You just go down in the street, you stick your thumb out, one of these things pulls up, and they're like, what do you want? You're like, you know, I'd like a hoagie, salami or whatever.
We got windows and we got fishing rods. I'd like the Three Stooges where they'd open the window and then lower the fishing rod and get the food off the top of the truck. Remember those?
All right, guys. Are we done? Yeah. So where can people go to find out more about Tim? Where are you on the Twitter and Facebook?
I have an infrequently posted to blog at timmurtaugh.com. We have our business site at monkeydo.biz. We have Twitter. It's monkeydobiz. I am Murtaugh on Twitter. Ediblecity.com. Now that it's out, you know, in the public and people know about it, let us know what you think of it. We think it could be really cool.
Jim, I'm really glad we're able to be here.
Can we tweet the password?
Yeah, we can tweet that. Lunchtime.
Lunchtime.
Yeah, I'm going to say.
So, Tim, thank you.
No, my pleasure.
Finally got you on the show after so long. you're finally willing to come on the show. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Yeah.
My pleasure. Thank you, Daniel.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. You can follow Jeffrey on Twitter. He's starting to use Twitter now. He's got a few followers. You could be one of the first to follow him at Zeldman. I'm Dan Benjamin on Twitter. We know Murtaugh on Twitter. And
I will pimp one more thing. You can follow Edible City at Edible NY.
NY. Do you plan on expanding to future cities soon?
Well, it seems like a natural extension.
I would like to suggest Austin.
Prepare. Edible NY.
Okay. And Edible NY also on Twitter. Thank you.
Yeah. And thank you very much.
You guys can go to 5x5.tv. You can hear previous episodes of this show. You can hear about all the other shows. Apparently, some of you are not listening to all of the shows. I'm hearing disappointed, a little hurt, working on it, working through it. But thanks for tuning in today. Rate the show on iTunes. This is important because it helps people find out about it. People who are looking for this kind of thing, the ratings help new people learn about the show. So thanks for that. Thanks to Shopify.com and Rackspace.com, King of the Apps. And everybody, we'll be right back here next week. We'll see you then.